Good afternoon. Welcome to our final case of the day for the Court of Appeals December panel. Thank you for joining us virtually since we're not all able to be together in person. These are being broadcast live and they will also be archived, although I don't think there's any personal information in these in this case. But just so you're aware, these will be preserved for future watching if anyone cares to do so. I am pleased today to be joined by our Chief Judge Mike Pirtle from Omaha and from Judge and with Judge Frank Moore from North Platte, and I'm Francie Reedman. With that, we will go ahead and get started. Our case before us is Millard Gutter Company versus Farm Bureau Property and Casualty Insurance Company. Mr. Becker, if you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, Millard Gutter submits that this case is about the notion of whether or not the court will require adherence to the standard notice pleading that a party is only required to set forth a short, plain statement of its claim. That principle has been repeated by numerous Nebraska appellate court cases, and as it relates specifically to the concept of a breach of contract action, the Supreme Court in Couturus versus Zerbe, which is cited in the brief, has said a plaintiff need only plead the existence of a promise, its breach, damages, and compliance with any conditions preceding activating a defendant's duty. In addition, as it relates to a bad faith claim, we believe that our complaint adequately stated a plausible or cognizable claim for bad faith that should have been allowed to proceed forward. We submit that the errors relative to the dismissal of the amended complaint are as set forth in the brief, relate to the notion that dismissing the bad faith claim without further development of a record was improper. Essentially, the court made reference to a United States federal court district decision in the context of a summary judgment motion about ruling about inchoate bad faith claims, but didn't allow the plaintiff in this case to develop the record on a potential bad faith claim and to examine it in the context of a motion for summary judgment as might be appropriate. We submit that under the case law, and including the Tyron case cited in our brief, under the standards of a motion to dismiss, it's not appropriate to make determinations on novel claims or claims in which there's no direct precedent. In this case, there's no Nebraska case that says an assignee of an insurance claim cannot pursue a bad faith claim.
What is your basis for an assignment of a first party bad faith claim? Doesn't there have to be a contractual relationship with the insurance company for that?
There has to be a contractual relationship with someone, and that's the Braish case, which says that that duty arises out of the implied good faith and fair dealing concept. But because we're an assignee, we stand in the shoes. We don't need contract directly with the insurance company if we stand in the shoes of the insured.
And didn't Braish also say that it doesn't apply to strangers to the contract?
But that's a different context. That Braish did not even examine the concept of whether or not there was an assignment. There are numerous cases in dealing with lenders that indicate that a party who takes the assignment stands in the shoes and is subject to all the defenses and can assert all the claims of its assignee. In this case, one of the items is a continuing duty of good faith and fair dealing by the insurance company. That's owed pursuant to the contractual promise. When an insured makes an assignment of its claim and says, okay, you go deal with the insurance company, you stand in my shoes, that continuing duty of good faith and fair dealing is owed to the person who takes the assignment and stands in the shoes. Therefore, we are no longer strangers to the contract because we stand in the shoes of the contracting party.
Don't the insureds have to have existing claims for bad faith at the time of the assignment?
No. There is a continuing duty of good faith and fair dealing under the contract. In addition, under the Nebraska insurance rules that set forth the guidance of the insurance company dealing with claims, they have a continuing duty to deal with that claim in bad faith. They can't simply walk away from the claim and say, well, now the insured has assigned it to somebody else. We're going to make a policy that we're going to disregard and ignore those assignments. We're going to disregard their requests for information because we don't believe those assignments are valid because we have an unenforceable provision in our policy that says we don't recognize assignments and therefore deprive a party of the rights that are due under that policy and the continuing obligation. But more importantly, that may be an argument that could be developed after discovery and at a summary judgment setting. It's not appropriate in the context of a motion to dismiss. All we need to do is state a cognizable claim, and we've stated that the insurance company has a duty of good faith and fair dealing that arises under the contract, that's confirmed by the Brace opinion. We say that we've received an assignment of claim, therefore we stand in the shoes of the insureds, and we should be able to assert any claims they could assert.
Are you arguing in essence that you are a third party beneficiary?
No, I'm saying that we stand in the shoes. It's no different than under the assignment statutes, and I don't have it off the top of my head, but I think it's cited in the brief. We could pursue an assignment claim in our name or in the name of the assignor. And so this no different than if we were John Smith assignor, if we brought the claim in his name because we were the rightful assignee of his claim, then we could pursue it. We're not.
So is your bad faith claim contractual in nature or is it tort in nature?
Under Brace, the tort arises out of the contractual duty of the implied obligation of good faith and fair dealing, as well as the statutory obligation and rule obligation are the rules promulgated by the Department of Insurance to continue to adjust the claims in good faith. You can't sit there and walk away from your continuing duty to make payment of the claim and ignore requests for information once an assignment's been made just because you take the position as an insurance company that, well, we don't recognize assignments.
So if the insured had assigned you the claim for this occurrence, is it your position that that would apply to an occurrence happening down the road? Say, for example, a tornado hit, that would automatically apply to that?
No. I mean, that's not the position we're taking. We're saying relative to the claim that we've been assigned out of these incidents, there's this continuing duty of good faith and fair dealing to adjust the claim properly, and the insurance company ignored that duty. As a consequence, we stand in the shoes relative to that assigned claim by those insureds, and we can pursue any claim that they could pursue.
So, Mr. Becker, if I understand your argument correctly, it doesn't matter when the assignment was made relative to this claim. In other words, if the assignment was made before the work was completed, the roof repair work was completed, that doesn't matter. Is that your position?
That's right, Your Honor. Because first, if they assign us any claim or interest that they have against their insurance company, then we get any pre-existing bad faith claims they have. But in addition, once we step into their shoes, we can pursue any further and additional claims that they may have or that may arise out of this policy. And once the insurance company takes the position that we're going to ignore this assignment, we're going to refuse to give information and process these claims because we don't recognize the assignment, because there's that continuing duty and because there's the continuing implied duty of good faith and fair dealing, I submit that we can continue to pursue those.
Mr. Becker, I want to direct your attention for a minute on your motion to make more definite and certain. Would you agree with me that the date on which the breach occurred is relevant to whether a statute of limitations defense exists?
No, Your Honor, we don't believe that that's appropriate under the case law. to use a motion to make more definite for that purpose. Dates specifically, the courts that have looked at the concepts of dates and affirmative pleadings of statute of limitations have said that's not the purpose of a motion to make more definite certain. The Christensen case cited by the appellee and relied upon by the district court was under code. It was not a notice pleading case. And so when you look at the notice pleading concept, the question becomes, is the claim unintelligible? I submit that under the amended complaint, the complaint is not unintelligible. Now, they can develop through discovery questions about dates. But again, as pointed out in the brief, some of that information will be beyond our control because they just took the position that they were ignoring the assignments and refused to communicate with us. So that is precisely the sort of thing that we can't allege with precision necessarily each and every breach. That's the point of saying that under the Kocher's case, all we have to allege is a promise, is breach, and damages. We've done that. We don't, under the Nebraska standards, have to allege a date. And it's improper to say that a party has to allege a date. The cases that look at it routinely really say items such as dates and information as dates is the subject of discovery, and it's a misuse of that motion to use it for date purposes.
I'm looking at Nebraska Court Rule 6-1109F that says, for the purpose of testing the sufficiency of a pleading, averments of time and place are material and shall be considered like all other averments of material fact. So if it's a material issue, why does it not have to be pled?
With respect to the breach of contract, there's no case that interprets that statute, as far as I'm aware of, that says that it's material to allege the date of each and every breach. That is information that we may not necessarily know, and the cases interpreted under the Nebraska Supreme Court, like the Kocher's case, they don't indicate that you have to look at dates.
Was date an issue in that case on the pleading?
I don't think date is necessarily an issue in this case. The statute of limitations is an affirmative defense that is not necessarily appropriate to determine at the pleading stage. That's an affirmative defense to be alleged in the answer. And we did allege dates in terms of the date of the assignment, the date of the storm that occurred. So we alleged sufficient basis to say, hey, we have a cognizable claim here because the claim is a breach of contract claim, which is subject to 5 years. We allege the date of the storm. We allege the dates of the assignments. Those are all within 5 years. If they want to dig down further into that, that's a subject matter of discovery. And I respectfully submit, under my reading of the cases, there's nothing that says you have to affirmatively plead the date of each and every breach that may take place.
With regard to the dismissal of the case, you were ordered to file an amended complaint, and you apparently decided not to do that and stand on your original amended complaint. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the court know that you were electing to stand on your existing amended complaint?
Our view was that we expected that a motion would be filed and that we would advise the court, and as opposed to an ex parte communication, once the 30 days ran, we anticipated that the defense would file a motion and that we would advise the court, hey, we're standing on the complaint. We think that we've stated a cognizable claim that we're entitled to relief, that we would have elected to stand, and we do elect to stand on the complaint as set forth in the amended complaint.
What about the local rules requiring action within a certain amount of time or else your case is dismissed?
That wasn't the basis of the court's ruling in terms of the progression of the case. That wasn't an issue that was developed or cited by the court. It was declining to pursue further amendment. And we stood on that amended complaint that we had filed, and I submit that under the cases that recognize a right to stand on a complaint, including as recently in 2019, there's a Supreme Court case, I think it's Rodriguez, that where they recognize that a party had the right to stand on a on a complaint, and the Supreme Court ultimately reversed a dismissal of causes of action after the party stood on the complaint.
But do you agree that you did not inform the court that you were standing on the amended complaint?
Your Honor, I cannot recall if there were discussions with the court at the hearing about whether or not we were standing. There's no pleading file that says that. I honestly can't recall if we articulated that or not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Allie, how far over did we take the appellant?
4 minutes, 27 seconds, Your Honor.
Would you add that to the appellee's time, Mr. Walton? If you would like the additional time, feel free to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have Ray Walden for Farm Bureau. May it please the court. I certainly hope I'm not going to need to use all that much more time. In fact, I believe anything that I say, I said better already in the brief. I'll refer you to that and try to make some sense out of this, maybe by going to the Supreme Court's decision from, I believe it was late August, in a number of these roofing cases, and there are a lot of them, but this one was Valley Boys versus American Family, and it kind of showed how these things work, the storm insurance and the roof repairs. Is, and of course, it starts with the storm, but then the insurance company does an estimate, pays actual cash value, which it reflects the how old the roof is and deteriorated already before the storm. Then the contractor is hired, and there is still a reserve for replacement cost. That is still yet to be paid on the condition that the repairs are actually done. And so then there's a formula in the policy about what is actually going to be paid depending on what's done. So here's where the assignment came in before the work was done, and that's fine. But what does an assignment do? It assigns the right to collect the insurance payments that would be due to the insured. And an assignment by case law is effective as to the rights that exist in the assignor at the time the assignment is made. Now, this is a little bit different because you still have what is the work going to be done and then what is going to be the replacement cost that's going to be dependent on that. So you have an assignment of the right to collect the payments, but it is not right that the roofer then stands in the shoes of the insured. The stand in the shoes metaphor is one of the limited kinds of things that you really have to look at underneath it. Doesn't become the policyholder by taking an assignment of proceeds. And there's nothing in the way that this is alleged that they say that they took over the policy. We don't have the assignment. That's something that usually we'll see as an attachment for on the roofing cases, right to the complaint. We don't know what purported to be assigned, but they don't say that they purported to assign anything other than the actual proceeds. So we're still working with the insured, maybe working with the contractor, because you have to, they're the one doing the work, negotiating what's going on, what's going to be done, what kind of materials have to be used, what's necessary. So we're not ignoring the assignment, we're respecting the assignment, but simply letting the process play out. So this is why it's important to know when this breach happened in each of these cases, because it starts off with a complaint that really doesn't say anything about anybody. There's no identification of any of the homeowners insured.
Mr. Walden, let me interrupt you. What was wrong with the amended complaint? Why was that not sufficiently pled?
Okay, well that helped a whole lot by telling us at least who these people are that they took assignments from. But it didn't say when the breach in each of those, you know, happened. And that's important to be able to assess, is there a defense? I mean, how are we going to answer this thing?
Isn't that what discovery's for?
Well, at this point, we're not doing discovery. We're figuring out, do we put in a statute of limitations defense or not?
Well, we have notice pleading now, and my recollection of notice pleading is you have to state just enough to show you have a cause of action, and then the rest of it is taken over in discovery. So again, what was the problem with this amended complaint that you couldn't have handled in discovery?
Well, I don't think notice pleading unless you just throw a label in and let it stand that way. There has to be some kind of facts that support that. And the facts here have to do with they're claiming that there was a breach of a contract, and in the way the contract was breached is bad faith, which is focused on the breach of contract. Well, when did it happen? Because there really wasn't a complaint that that alleged who they have assignments from until it's almost 11 months after the original complaint. So in the meantime, there's a whole span of several months that if that breach happened, then you're more than 5 years out from the original complaint, I mean, from the amended complaint. So that's why the district court latched on to this idea that, yes, indeed, it's a more definite and certain statement is needed to be able to assess whether there's a limitations defense here.
Why would the amended complaint not relate back to the original complaint?
Because there's really nothing there. There's nothing that establishes subject matter jurisdiction. You don't know how many people there were involved. I mean, what the assignments were supposed to have been. We can't identify, we can't go to our books and say, oh, okay, here's who they are, and then start to formulate an answer. It's just there's nothing that would establish subject matter jurisdiction to be able to bring a breach of contract claim by somebody who admittedly is not in contract with the insurance company and is just saying, oh, but we have assignments from somebody who is. Go fish.
When you're saying it didn't establish subject matter jurisdiction, what are you referring to?
Well, we're at the Valley Boys case. That says you need a valid assignment for subject matter jurisdiction, and an insurer has standing to challenge that. But the basic thing is you need a valid assignment if you're not alleging that you're actually in contract in the contract.
So if I'm a plaintiff and I simply allege a breach of contract case and I say I have a valid assignment, that's not good enough to get by a motion to make more definite or a motion to dismiss?
Not unless you say, whose contract was it to begin with? You're just saying, I have a contract. Okay, who was it?
Well, they gave you a list of policyholders and addresses, didn't they?
Not then. That was
no, but in the amended complaint they did, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, at the amended complaint. But the amended complaint was almost 11 months after the original complaint. So we have that time factor, because the original complaint was just exactly 5 years after the storm. And then all these things are alleged in the amended complaint about what happens during the next few months. And it's no later than October of that, of 2014, or 2013, the storm is when the storm was in April. No later than October of 2013 is the last of these assignments. And in every case, they say they did the work after that. So there's still several months that the breach had to have happened sometime. If it happened within 5 years of the amended complaint, okay, fine, there's no defense. But when was the breach on all of these? Because there are several months we just don't know, and that's what the judge said we're entitled to know. But the real point is the judge said we're entitled to know, and then nothing happened. And the judge still standing on the, still operating under that original motion that the order went out on, then said, okay, that's enough. We gave you 30 days. It's been several months here, 4 months or so. Just went ahead and executed on the The order did that under authority. There's the Supreme Court Rule 6112E says that a more definite and certain motion is granted if the order is not obeyed within the time the court fixes. The court may strike the pleading or make such order as it deems just. It doesn't say anything about needing a new motion. And then there's Number of Stat Section 25-6015. That allows a dismissal without prejudice or disobedience by the plaintiff of an order concerning the proceedings in the action. That's the authority the court was working under. And you know, so if the case is, if that decision is upheld here, that's it. I mean, it's without prejudice. And we don't need to actually get to the bad faith question. But on the bad faith, I think the district court kind of recognized that the nature of that tort versus the nature of an assignment are such that that an assignment of a claim to insurance proceeds really can't convey any rights to the assignee of the proceeds. That can lead to the kind of harm, potential harm, to the assignee because of the insurer abusing or acting in bad faith with respect to the duties to the policyholder. Miller.
But Mr. Walden, isn't the duty to the policyholder to adjust the claim and pay the claim?
Yes, indeed. And we continue on with those duties to the policyholder with it in mind that when we have to pay that extra money, if work is actually done, the replacement cost is paid out.
And there's right. And so isn't that duty to the policyholder subject to being assigned to the assignee here?
No, they're not assigning all rights and duties under the policy. You don't move the policy over to the policy. This is an assignment of a chosen action for the proceeds. It would be clearer if we had the assignments, because those are the way that these have been worded. But the complaint, the painted complaint, does not say that everything was assigned as far as the entire policy. And I don't think you can do that anyway. It's just the proceeds. So there's just not a brush requires that there be some consequential harm that occurs not making the payments of the proceeds or being delayed in. And there are other cases, like the Court of Appeals with the Bailey versus, I think it was Farmers Union, where a woman was had the right to have her house replaced after a total loss, and the company just wasn't doing it, and she had to move out. She had incurred lots of different expenses as a, in consequence to the simple non-payment. If it's just not paying the policy proceeds, that's not bad faith by definition. And the district court picked up on that. Grosh establishes that that rule hasn't changed. So that's why I say an assignment is incompatible of policy proceeds is incompatible with the notion that there are still duties owed to the assignee that can be breached in bad faith. The duty is to pay the money once it's due under the terms of the policy. If it would be due to the insured, we'll pay that. Oh, here's the assignment. We'll pay it to where that's supposed to go. But we don't owe a duty to the, to the assignee. The duty is still to the insured. And
does the insurance company have a duty to act in good faith with the assignee?
There's no duty that arises from the insurance policy to do so. I think the duty is still to the insured. Because there'd be harm to the insured if you don't pay what's due under the policy to when they have this contract. I think there is that going on. But there's not the, but it's not in the sense of Roche where, I mean, they created the first party insurance bad faith by analogy to the third party insurance bad faith, where in a third party situation, you have control over, you know, like the liability defense, you know, the settlement, all that. So you have control over the insured, and, you know, if there's consequent harm from abusing that control, then you owe beyond the policy limit. For first party, the analogy is, well, there's some consequential harm that can happen here too, if you're not paying, such as the case where a delay in payment means somebody doesn't get an operation under a health insurance policy when they should be having it, with the harm that results from that. If it's just not paying out the proceeds, then that is exactly the same claim as the assigned claim for the proceeds.
Okay. Thank you. Have any further questions?
No.
Okay. The case is submitted. Council is excused. Again, thank you for joining us on this virtual platform today.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both.
Thank you both.